Neil Diamond said, "Have you ever heard a story about a frog who dreamed of becoming a king and then became one? Well, except for the names and a few other changes, if you're talking about Leth Own, the story is the same one. Leth was a virtual slave under the Khmer Rouge, but now protects the leader of the free world. After escaping the killing fields, transitioning through refugee camps, and adapting to life in America, Leth joined the Secret Service. A pivotal moment in his life and career came when in 2012, he escorted President Barack Obama to the land of his birth, Cambodia. Leth chronicles his life's journey in his new book, A Refugee's American Dream."
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of C4 Podcast, Southeast Asian Athlete Achievement Through Adversity. And while the majority of our guests are athletes, our guest today is an amazing individual from Southeast Asia. He actually, while not being athletic, like I'm sure he had to do a lot of physical, his job was working in the Secret Service, so I'm pretty sure he had a lot of physical activity, and there just, you know, definitely a lot of physical skill involves, and not only physical, but probably, you know, and mental as well. But I'm sure he's had a lot more physical skill than me. I just picked up and put down weights as a living. So anyways, if you guys haven't already, please go ahead and like, comment, share our page, Loud American Sports on Facebook. We're on Instagram, Loud American Sports, and also follow us on YouTube, Spotify, C4 Podcasts, and Loud American Sports Hall of Fame. So without further ado, I'm going to let my co-host, John Messina, introduce our guests for this evening.
Yeah, hello, everybody. We are going to be diving into this book today, A Refugee's American Dream. It is the life story of Mr. Leth Own, Secret Service agent. Most of the story is, how did he even get there? Survived the killing fields in Cambodia, adapted to America, and now protects the leader of the free world. We also have with us today Joe Samuel Starnes. Joe is Leth's co-author, and they have a history together, which we'll get into later. The two of them came together to tell this really incredible story. I had the honor of reading both Kenya Prock's book, which, if you guys, a couple episodes back, we had Kenya on, and Leth Own's books back to back right before I went to Cambodia for the first time for the SEA Games. So before we get into the interview, I want to thank everybody who supported us in our mission to bring a contingent of Lao American athletes to the SEA Games in Cambodia. It was very successful, very fun. The swimmers didn't medal, but they did great. Highest finish for the Lao swim team in history. Our wrestler, Dawson Sihavong, out of Stanford University, got a couple medals brought home. So overall, great experience for everybody. And thank you to everybody who supported that campaign and supported us in that mission. A lot more to come on that. So with that, we're going to go ahead and start diving into this exciting interview today. So before we get into the details of Leth's story, I just want to set the stage. Joe, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you and Leth even met and came to the point of writing the book.
Sure. Well, I'm a novelist and have been a journalist for many years. And I was at the time, about 12 years ago, I was the editor of Widener University's alumni magazine. And it was a really slow July day. And a sociology professor who had been Leth's professor brought him by and said, "Hey, here's somebody you should write a profile of," just completely out of the blue. And, you know, I didn't know what to expect. Usually that's somebody who made partner in their accounting firm and the university's going to hit them up for a gift. Anyway, I said, sit down. He told me his story and it blew my mind. He was just such a remarkable, you know, I knew a little bit about the killing fields in Cambodia. And then to go from that to the Secret Service was remarkable. So I wrote a magazine article about him, which I was never happy with. I tried to talk to the man for an hour and a half and condense his life into about 800 words, and I just couldn't get it right. So I didn't feel like we'd done a great job with it. But fortunately, he was happy with it. And he got some extra copies, and we stayed in touch. And he had told me at the time that I want to write a life story about write a book about my life story. And I said, "Well, you absolutely should." not thinking that one day I would be the one to help him with it. But 5 or 6, you know, he wrote 50,000 words on his own, and 5 or 6 years later came back and, talked about what he had. And I said, you know, the time was right for me. So that was 2017. We started meeting. Another professor from Widener, Dr. Barbara Ryan, a sociology professor Leth was close to, helped us as an editor. And like 3 or 4 hard years of work, and then a year or two looking for a publisher, and here we are with the book, so which was published in February. And I never wanted to be anybody's ghostwriter or co-author. It wasn't a goal of mine, but I couldn't be happier that I met Leth and I did this, because it's been transformative for me, just in my whole view of the world, and to appreciate, you know, the upbringing that I've had. So it's been a real privilege to get to know him and to work with him on this book.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah. So Leth, tell us about your early years. Tell us about, you know, childhood, growing up, when and where you were born, and your experience with the Khmer Rouge.
I was born in Cambodia, Battambang City, which is the north, close to Thailand border.
Okay.
My father military, and how I met my mom was one day, my mom was based upstream, and my dad was like, who is this? And, I'm going to marry her. So the Asian cultures, a woman cannot go about upstream, you know. So later on, 1966, I was born. From there on, 8 years, 9 years. We are poor, born poor always. My dad, the military, don't make any money. Most of the time, he deployed. Weeks, months, sometimes fight the battles. My mom had to take 2 jobs. She couldn't enough support us. She seamstress, rolled tobaccos, and I was a sick child. Most of the time, my mom said I was never going to make it because how sick I was. So I grew up 3-4 years old and went to school, and poor is poor, but we all have a happy life among ourselves. Until 1975, of course, things changed ever since then. So my dad was last time one of the school, and he was wearing those green uniform, no shirts, with a little handkerchief around his head. And
this is after the Khmer Rouge.
After the Khmer Rouge. Yeah. So I was happy until then, you know. Even my dad's not home with us all the time, but I'm still happy. My mom's here taking care of us, make sure we get fed. You know, go to school, education, because that's what my dad always wanted me to do, go to school. He told me, be a doctor or someone can use a brain, don't have to carry a gun like this. But here I am, you know, some years, 40, 50 years later, I tell people it's in my blood. It's in my blood, so.
Yeah. So then, we're going to leave most of the details to folks who read the book, but the Khmer Rouge takes over, upends it. Maybe just kind of tell us, whatever you're comfortable with Leth speaking on, kind of what transpired and then ultimately how you escaped the country.
When I took my dad or whatever is gone, I think it's second or third day, the Khmer Rouge, you know, trying to go around, find out the males of who sold the country. I mean, sold the country by meaning like any kind of government official, government employees, teacher, professors, any high school, college, they gathered all and put them in one place. And my mom was, it was like, get everybody inside the house. We don't have a house per se. We, everything covered by the curtain. Get in the house. And she had one of the pictures, my dad picture in uniform, black and white. She pulled it down, hide it. And the Khmer Rouge walked in there with AK-47, screaming, yelling at us, look for the man. But we told him we don't have any men there. And my dad's, you know, his God left us a long time ago. And that was the, you know, things started to change ever since then. And we, you know, it's kind of a good thing that my dad's not with us. And he was with us, he's probably going to take all of us and kill us anyway. Not to refuse to know, to recognize my dad, but one of the things that's we will survive because my dad wasn't there with us. And from there on, they forced evacuators from all the cities, everybody who's there. AK-47 shot in the sky and chased us, so we have to go. And ever since then, we never get back home since, you know.
Yeah. So, you know, this was a very intense part of the book. Everybody, I encourage you to read it. It's a firsthand account of what happened there. I guess, Joe, what was it like writing this part of the book about the Khmer Rouge with Leth?
Well, it was, you know, I remember the first interview we really sat down to go through what he had written and sort of expand the narrative. And it was, you know, he saw his father for the last time, you know, right as the Khmer Rouge came in and took over, and they turned the schools into prisons. So, and he was able to go in and see his father. So we're asking questions about this, and it was just, you know, it was really an emotional thing to go back through. And I mean, I can't admire him enough for being willing to revisit all of these memories and, you know, to go through that, to talk about the last time you saw your father. And, you know, hasn't seen him since, and has, you know, tried to find out what might have happened, but there's been no, you know, what are we talking about, 48 years later?
Yeah.
Still don't know. So he, you know, Leth was, but he never complained once, you know. And I know that at times too, you know, there were stories like, well, you know, when you were in the rice paddies and this happened, you know, about what time of day was it, or how hot was it, or what month was it? And he, like, sometimes he'd go, I don't know, it was 40 years ago. But and then he, yeah, we would work back to the story. So, and I think like a lot of memories, you remembered a lot of things that you hadn't thought. And I think you probably told me a lot of things that you hadn't told anybody, you know, as we got into writing the book.
It is. It's a lot of things that I kind of remember, I don't remember. So it's put a thing in together there. I wrote at the moment what I could remember. But yep. As I go along with Sam, and Sam keep asking questions, those things coming back. It's like one of the things, well, when you left there, when the Vietnamese liberated the country, what you do? So I walk back, and then that's one of the part I forget. I was kidnapped, interrogated at the age of 12, you know, tied me to the chair, beat me up, put a scoop in, stung me, all kind of things like that. It's like, sometimes it is so kind of painful you don't want to remember, but in order to put in a book, put a writing, you have to put it out there to educate people. You know, like one of the chapters, as you said, you know, I'm not gonna die today. So always look back to those. I didn't die then. So I'm not gonna die tomorrow because of a little thing that happened. So Sam has brought a lot of my old memories back. The painful memories that I didn't want to remember. So he helped me a lot of those too as questions go on. But yeah, like Sam said, we don't have clock. We don't have them, you know, go to school, you had to wake up your own time. And many times, you know, you're late. At one point, I would talk to Sam about it. You've probably seen that, you know.
Yeah.
Get up late, walk through the Cambodian national anthem and try to walk. Cops stopped me. They beat me one with a baton. So when I got to school, I get 5 lashes because I was 5 minutes late. So from there on, you kind of try to, you know, almost set up a time, get up early. Just sometimes you're way early to go to school just to make sure. Then, you know, I wouldn't call it punishment. It's kind of discipline. Yeah. So.
And you know, Leth and I are 4 months apart, and he's 4 months older than I am. That's why I still have a little bit of hair left. but he, yeah, I try to think back. I don't remember what I was doing in 1976 with detail. So it was a lot of trying to go back and remember what happened and remember details. And his memory has really been remarkable to put it all down. And I mean, I think he thought it was an important thing to do to tell the story.
Yeah.
It's so true about that. Yeah.
Yeah. Same with Kenya. We had Kenya on, read his book, and he said he knows you, Leth, Kenya Pratt. He wanted to tell the story to kind of give a voice to those who couldn't tell their stories because they're not here. So he felt like he has to tell the story for them.
Right.
One of the things that was eye-opening in your book, because like everybody, I read the seen history books on the Khmer Rouge, saw what the killing fields or whatever. After the Vietnamese took over, I was kind of an impression that things kind of got better and everybody started going about their way. It was basically anarchy. There's no government. People are homeless. They have no homes. They lost everything. And then even escaping, right? It's not like you just said, all right, now I'll walk to Thailand. There's landmines. There's rogue soldiers. I mean, just briefly tell us a little bit about the kind of the whole escape and the aftermath.
So, like you said, after the Vietnamese liberated, there's no government. It's country so chaotic. We have so many bags of rice to survive. My mom, you know, I've telling people today, the love, the love of a mother from her heart is stronger than you can imagine. She back then at 59, 60 years old, but she did everything as a mother could do to make sure that the kids get fed, the kids, you know, survive. We got there. My mom's always go out there, do the trading, something, whatever she could. And the thing is getting worse after that. And we don't have enough rice to eat, food to eat, and pretty much vegetable. We go out there, pick up, we call it watercress from the rice paddy. It's just enough to make it to survive. So my mom heard that if you go to the borders, you know, you can trade, you can buy something cheap, but you have to bring it back to sell. You make somewhat decent money, not to be rich. But the journey, the pathway, the travel, it's very, very dangerous in a way. Because from there, about, 75 miles long, we left there with my mom. I never separate my mom. That's why my mom and I are so close. When she's gone, like half of my body was gone. My dad is too, but he's pretty much, I was so young then, I didn't do as much as with my mom, but because a mother as a woman, you know, the strong, the love of the mother, such a strong love that she had for us. So we walked there nonstop. We couldn't get enough money. Not enough money. It's the food, the water, stuff like that. We have enough. Hopefully we can make it there. Sometimes we don't have that. We run out of water. Sometimes we run out of food. So middle of the waters, yeah. Sometimes we drink a water from the elephant footprints. It's not sanitized, not filtered. You make a cup, just, you know, clear the algae on the top of the scoop, but you go to the next one. And many times you don't have food. We find any leaf, any grass, anything digestible to just to survive. We don't have enough, you know, steak or something. But my mom, sometimes she would give the water to me, make sure I drink before she drinks. But we got there. Sometimes it takes 3 days, 4 nights. It's a nonstop journey. We don't stop. And sometimes it takes longer, depending how the condition of the journey. Sometimes you get caught in a lot of gunfights. Sometimes, you know, people are stepping on landmine, get killed, so we have to move on to the next things. And I told her this morning, after so many days, 110 degrees, scorching heat, and we run out of water, we walked, a group of us walked to one of the ponds. It's water so clear, like, okay, it's clear water. You know, everybody went there, drank the waters. I always curious about where I am. My mom's just yell at me, don't go there. There's a lot of landmine, stuff like that. So I walked up there. After a drink of water, there's look like three logs in a lake or the pond there, but it turned out to be a mother's, a father, and a baby that I was dead there, who knows how long, the body decomposed. So I told my mom, a buddy that with me, like, hey, those are not logs or wood, those are the bodies. Some of the people like throw up, some people became sick later on, but I was so fortunate that I didn't get any sick, anything like that. So that's what I, one of the things I said, the COVID has nothing on me. So here I am. So, but the journey is bad. We've seen a lot of stuff, facing the tigers, cobra, seeing people get blown up because we have to follow each and everyone footprints, no foot, barefoot all the time. So we have to follow everyone footprints. And sometimes you missed it, you're dead. So when something get blown up, we have to keep on moving because then the Vietnamese is going to come down. The Khmer is going to come down. The Thai is going to, you know, launch all the rockets. So we have to go. Sometimes people move there, they step on the landmine and, you know, just keep on moving. So I was so fortunate that I didn't step on the landmine and getting killed by a tiger, eaten by a tiger, get bit by king cobra and stuff. So I always think somebody's up there watching them. Probably my dad is watching me the whole time. Who knows?
Yeah. Wow. It's intense. Well, so then you you finally go through the refugee camp system, which a lot of our listeners, like, you know, came, like my wife, Lao refugee camps and co, and that came through the camps, and were sponsored to America, kind of similar to you. You got ended up on the East Coast, but so you land in America. Tell us a little bit about what was it like. I mean, you go from Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, not even the normal Cambodia, to, you know, the East Coast, dense population, big cities.
The toughest thing is, like, when I landed, I looked around. It's not even close to the culture shock, you want to call it that way. And then people speak a different language than me. I said, how am I going to survive this country? This, I can't go back. I can't go back because I'm here. It's not like one of the things you buy a flight tickets, go back, and I'm done. So every morning I get up and walk around the blocks just to observe what's going on. I couldn't walk maybe a block just to see. And one day I told myself, you know, start high school. One day I told myself, you know, I told my mom the same thing. I said, if I want to live in this country, I got to learn English. That's priority. So start high school. I went to all the summer schools, anything at all that they open, I went there. And working same time, 2-3 jobs, you know, walk to work. Best job I have, the first one, washing dishes in a Chinese restaurant, $3.50. The greatest thing that happened, you get a manager working 15, 16 hours a day in rice paddy, you barely have anything to eat. Now, I work not as hard as back in the communist. I actually get paid 315 cents an hour. So it was the greatest thing. And my first paycheck was whatever happened. I lost a $78 first paycheck too. So it's, you know, and from there on, I every summer, I pick up 2 jobs or 3 jobs. I work 7-Eleven, McDonald's, you know, washing dishes, grocery store, riding a bicycle. And I even think in this country, it's new to me. It's like born again. It's culture is different. The way people act, it's language itself. It's everything, like you do born again. So I have to learn everything again. You know, I made it through 40 years ago.
And how old were you when you came to the States?
18.
18, okay. See, I was 4, so it was very easy. It was a culture shock, but it was easily, I adapted quickly, right? I mean, I was barely speaking Lao, and all of a sudden, okay, learning the language. I'm 4 years old. You go to school. I can only imagine how, for you to be 18,
right.
And you're a full, you're an adult, man.
Right.
You're learning, you're starting over, so.
Since this is a sports podcast, tell the story about the first experience with a professional football game.
Yeah.
So we come here, and it was back then called Washington Redskins. We live in Prince George's County. And Redskins won the playoff and Super Bowl then. And, you know, the firecrackers. So my mom and I was crawling under the bed. So there's some more gunfire there. And, you know, we stay under the bed the entire night. So in the morning, when people are asking me, you know, you see this, see that. I said, what happened last night? Was somebody shooting somebody? They said, no, that's firecrackers. Celebrate Redskins won the playoff or won the Super Bowl. Remember that time? They're like, you know, it's like we still have. So I say still the memories back and still there. It's still fresh there. So any crack, anything at all, like, oh, my God, there's gunfire again.
No. Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
So tell us how you got into the Secret Service. I'll just tell us a little bit about the Secret Service as much as you can, right? But then tell us how you got interested and what made you decide to pursue that.
So it started off like I want to try to buy it myself. Like I work with Chinese restaurant, $3.15 an hour. So if I can make $3.15, why can't I try to find something $4.15? So I keep on going. So come here, Secret Service, if, you know, we Asian, we have those fortune tellers. If someone come and like, hey, you tell your future what you're going to be in Secret Service, I would say, okay, you know what, stop for pulling my leg. That's not going to happen. When the Secret Service come out and say, like, you know, 6'3", you know, 280-pound muscular, stuff like that, you know, never think a guy, what, 5'5", 175, you know, bald head, you join the Secret Service, never thought about it. So when I done my college scratch of wine, I worked a little bit before that. I worked probation, juvenile probation agent in Philadelphia. Then when I graduated from Weiner, I went to work with social workers. So I said, well, if I work with social work, let me try something else. So I went to the federal building in Philadelphia. They look for correctional officers. So a correctional officer looks good. I didn't even know what it was then. I have no idea. So I put my name, my phone, social security number over there. And this is why I tell a story about when they called me, offered me a job for Department of Justice. So Miss Beverly Primo, she called me and said, I'm looking for, this is Les Owen. I said, that's me. Well, I'm calling from Department of Justice. I said, well, time out. I don't owe you any taxes. So why are you calling me? She was like, listen, you know, I'm not calling to collect taxes. They said, well, look at this person and you apply for a job with us. I said, what job is that? I said, correctional officer. I have no idea what it is. So I told, what is correctional officer? She's like, you don't know what it is? I said, no, but it sounds good. So she had to tell me what it is. I'm like, okay, you know, let's try. I said, I wasn't born here. I was born overseas. You know, I told her, I immigrant in this country, Cambodian refugee. She's like, oh, you're a citizen, you're good. So we went to take a test, pass it, you know, worked there over 3 years. Started in 1999. So when 9/11 happened, I went to Army base recruit in Philadelphia, say, hey, I want to volunteer to go to Afghanistan. Back then, after 9/11, they need a lot of people. So back then, I was like 33, close to 34 already anyway. They kind of look at me like, hey, okay, we'll call you. So 25 years later, I'm still waiting for that phone call that we get called. So I went back to the federal building. And they see, you know, secret so high. I said, you know, here we go again. They're like, no, what's, you know, what could happen? What could be the worst thing happen? So I apply and to, you know, become a sick service officer. And I told him, I said, well, I work for Department of Justice already. You know, I said, okay. It's like, oh, well, you're on the system. You know, it's good. But before that, way back when I came here working Tenley Market, I ran to a couple of those guys. And
that's a convenience store officer in Washington.
Yep.
Yeah. So I adopted the name Mark because they called me Marcos. First of all, they thought I was a Filipino. So I tell them my real name, they couldn't pronounce it. They said, well, we just call you Mark from there on. So Mark is my nickname from there on. So come to Secret Service and, you know, applied it. Went to take a test, and I had to take a test twice, you know. So 21 years later, that's how I joined the Secret Service.
Wow, 21 years. So everybody, just to make sure everybody knows, the Secret Service is the organization that guards the president, the vice president, the first lady, any of the big VIPs in Washington. Yes. So if you're looking for some nice, juicy inside details, unfortunately, you've come to the wrong place. We're not gonna be, you know, giving you any dirty laundry, because it is called the Secret Service for a reason, right, Leth?
For a reason, yeah. Yes.
For a reason. Yeah. And obviously he can't go into the things I'm sure some people would love to hear. But maybe just describe your job a little bit, Leth.
When I started, I was assigned first to the vice president when Dick Cheney was in the office. And first thing, they sent me to a bike patrol. I said, they asked me, do you know how to ride a bike? I said, well, ride a bike so many times, you know, 8-9 miles. And, you know, the place where the vice president is staying, it's not far from Tenley Market. So they sent me to the bike course, finish that, come back, we'll do a bike patrol. And then before the canine comes up, they asked me again, it's like, hey, the canine position, being a canine handler, is coming up. Do you want to work with dog? I said, I'm a dog lover. I had dogs now. I had dog before back that, you know, you don't even come and say, okay, well, you know, write a memo. And so happened that the last day, the deadline that the memo has to be submitted, one of the captain lost my memo too. So I had to go back home, get a memo. So, but like I said, everything happened recently. So I was K-9 almost 9 years, travel around the world, you know, went back home, Cambodian with President Obama, Michelle Obama, the latest one with President Biden there. Meet my sister the first time since 79. You know, I thought she was dead, but mm-hmm. she's alive. We meet face to face the first time there. So from a canine healer to be a canine instructor, and that's what you know, when we start to write a book there, because it's a lot of going being a canine handler and canine instructor, you do a lot of traveling. So where would they present the vice president, dignitary, the head of state comes, we have to travel with them. So I want to write a book a long time ago, but the work is so busy. So yeah. Here I am, 4 more months to go. I mean, retired.
Oh, wow. That's it. And when you read the book, folks, the dog is very significant, right, in the story, Leth, because you had a dog, unfortunately, with the Khmer Rouge. You lost the dog, and then, you know, you kind of come full circle with being a dog handler. I felt kind of reconnecting there to your childhood. I mean, what was it like going back to Cambodia? You know, you were essentially, the last time you were there, you were like a slave and then sort of homeless. And then now you're going back guarding the leader of the free world, right?
Yes. When I got there, well, first I called my sister. I said, hey, she knew before I even got there. It's like, are you coming to Cambodia? I said, this is way back before even we know that we're going. I said, where are we going? I said, go back home. They'll set up the President Obama's coming. I said, I don't know. I don't want to think about it. So when I knew for sure it's going, and then I called, I said, hey, how big is the airport? Because when my dad took it, it's a small airport, C-17, 3-4, that's not going to fit it, you know. So my sister asked me, like, why did you ask that? I said, well, we get big planes. It's not just a little tiny. It's big planes. Like, how big is the plane? I said, it's big planes. I can't. So we got there and say, oh, well, and back then, Sayanu that passed away, so Chinese brought over, with, you know, big plane too. I said, oh, we got a big airplanes. I said, okay, we got a lot of big airplanes coming. I said, I don't know if it's going to fit it. So we landed, you know, I looked around left and right, the palm tree and stuff like that. I said, somebody's going to shoot me, because when my dad took me the first time over there, first and last time there, it's nothing but rocket explosion. Came outside, my dog's in there, like, you know, when you're going to take me out, he kind of looked at me and tell me, hey, you know, knucklehead, get me out of here quick. So I came outside, look out of there, like, okay, you know what? This is 2012. It's not 1975 anymore. Nobody's going to shoot me. So I take a deep breath, you know, smell the dust and, you know, the trash and everything there, and humid's kicking in. I'm like, yeah, this is Cambodia, you know. So I took my dog out. He looked at me. It's kind of like, it's about time you let me out of the kennel. You mean sitting there for, you know, hours in there. And that's what's the first time I met my sister since 1979. So 33 years, we met face to face. And she came to look for me, and she drove around a couple of times. Somebody drove around. We looked at her. She looked at me. So finally she got off and came, started to talk to me. And then, you know, with two adults crying each other in front of the hotel lobby there. And like, you know, we can't do this. We're adults. So took it upstairs. And, you know, of course, she met my dog. Well, dogs, my dog's name is Roy. He's bilingual also. They speak English and Cambodian, so it's job security in the way you look at it. So yeah. My dog's like, hey, what are you doing? You know, I said, I mean, like I said, you know, you can't lie to a judge, but you can't lie to a dog. Dog smells you and sends you everything. So that's the first time I met my sister in 33 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. That was a great part of the book, of how she had to be sent away for her safety. Yes. Into a small village, and but you guys were separated, but it's just wonderful to see that you could come back even after all these decades. He talks about how he found her in the book, and you'll have to read the book if you want those details.
Well, the book itself, I just want to add that like Sam and I, you know, he did more work than me. Sam is like me. He knows about my life than myself. So him and I, the proceeds of the book were donated to help the Cambodian kids in Cambodia, you know, provide some fresh water, school supplies. We were thinking of building the school that they held my father. I went there on my own to see that. We were thinking about starting to the bathroom for the boys and girls first. Because hygiene is the most important there. We start from the bathroom, like an almost like American system bathroom, and then go to the library. Bigger, maybe put some more books, put some more resources in there, and depend how much the proceed we get in a book. we may even hire and tutors teach them English or something there. So the proceeds of, again, it goes to help the community, because I know grow up to be poor. I don't have any flip-flops to wear to school, pretty much bark and barefoot. Can't even have a toy that costs about 50 cents. Probably say the one scavenging plastic aluminum for just less than a penny to help my mom. So I know how to be poor. And, you know, my 12 years, when I'm 12, 13 years old, the comet is a comet will rob the childhood from me. So I grew up to be a man when I'm 12 years old. So everything taught me ever since then. Yeah,
that's great that you guys are donating proceeds to help people in Cambodia. I just got back from Cambodia, like I said earlier, at the SEA Games. The country's been through a lot, but to be honest, I was impressed. It is on the up.
Yes.
The level of development, you go to Phnom Penh, there are cranes everywhere. There is construction everywhere. There are condos. There are sky rises. There's an air of optimism. There's still poverty, right? It's not America. Sure. There's a long way to go, but it is moving in the right direction, I felt. And it is advancing and developing and probably getting better every day. But it's still, there's a long way to go. And there's a whole segment of the society that's not necessarily benefiting from all that yet, right? That people like you could help. And it starts with, education at a school. That's the next generation. So very admirable of you guys to donate some of the proceeds.
Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, Joe, so one of the things for me about this book is that although you were poor, Leth, it starts out kind of like a normal, happy childhood. You're playing in the river. Of course, it takes a dark turn and kind of even gets worse. And then there's optimism, and then it kind of ends up with a happy story. Joe, what was the emotional ride here as you're writing this or listening to him?
I think that it sort of starts, or definitely has tears of sadness, but ends up with tears of joy. And the one thing that I was very fortunate, I'd never met Les' mother. I really regret, she lived to be 101 and she died in 2018. But in 2019, I guess there are three services that in the Buddhist tradition, there's a funeral shortly after the death, 100 days out. Right. And then there, 1 year, there's a big celebration. And he had that at his home, and my wife and I attended it. And it was such a remarkable thing to see all of his family and friends and just the love they had for one another. And it was really great to be there to see that. And to help him, that's the epilogue of the book. It's writing about sort of the family and coming together, and they haven't forgotten what they endured, but they appreciate, and they're happy. They've been able to find happiness from that. And, I think another thing about the book's been out since February now, and at most of the events and the readings we've done, there will be Cambodian there, many of them who've survived the killings and the bond that they have and the love that they have for one another is just really touching, because you can't, to have gone through that and survived, they're really strong and they appreciate and love one another. So that's been a really great part of the experience of writing this book.
Wow. Yeah.
And it sounds amazing so far. And like, I haven't read the book, right? So, and John knows I'm not much of a reader, but just hearing what you've, left, what you've been talking about, what you've been sharing, I'm compelled, to pick up and read. I hope our viewers, I hope you guys can agree, you guys will definitely do the same. Leth, when it comes to, let's say someone wants, a young kid wants to get involved with the Secret Service, what type of advice, or something similar to the Secret Service, like what type of advice would you give them? Talk like, a teenager, someone graduating high school, if they had some interest.
Go to school, aim high, work hard, and don't quit. You'll be there. It's nothing in this country, in America. Nothing. It's impossible. It might be difficult. It's a lot of difficult for me. I just said, coming here, no English, no penny to be who I am today. And also, Secret Service established in 1865. I am the first native-born Cambodian immigrant in this country to join Secret Service, so 150 years. So if I can make it, everybody can make as well. It's sometimes one has more difficulty than others. But if you want to get there, you'll be there. You can't run, walk, can't walk, crawl. You will be there. When I joined the service, I'm 35, 36 already. You know, kids can do it younger. I think they're accepted now 21. So keep yourself clean, go to school, you know, do what you need to do, set up a goal and move on. I mean, it's there. You know, the only thing I can say today about parents is that, you know, we all busy growing up, you know, the parents growing older too. So I always tell kids, you know, listen to your parents, respect them. You do some good thing for them. So they only been here for so long, they be gone. And then, you know, you wish, could, hey, I could have done this, could have, they gone, it's too late. You know, my mom and I, again, you know, I did a lot of everything that I possibly can help her to make sure she's happy. So,
yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. Great advice. So, folks, please, yeah, get this book. It is a great read. To be honest, if you read this in Kenya's book back to back like I did, it's really special because you see so many similarities. I did something for Kenya. I actually left I finished his book on the flight to Cambodia, and I left it there in his birthland. His book's newer than yours, so it was the first copy in Cambodia. I don't know if any of yours have made it over there yet, Leth, but I regret not leaving yours there too, to be honest.
There's people who want it, but there's a few people I gave the book to sign, but they want in Cambodia. Most of them don't really at the reading level yet, so we're working on that. So
it was more symbolic. He asked me to leave it for somebody. More symbolic. No, right. You know, even people can't read this. This is, you know, these are hard reads. It's a long book.
Right.
But more symbolic to leave it in his birthplace, you know.
I would like to say that on October 10th, there will be an audiobook will be released.
I was just going to ask about that.
It's on my birthday too.
Oh, wow.
October 10th.
Okay. That's great, folks. If you like audiobooks, grab that. Who's voicing it?
An actor named Tim Lunibus, who is an actor in San Francisco, and he's been on a number of television shows and has done a lot of stage work. So we are excited to have him doing it.
Okay. Yeah. We're excited to hear about that. So, guys, we appreciate coming on. Co, anything else for them?
No. Great. Thank you for coming on. Great interview, and, you know, much success to you, Leth, and Joe, Sam, in the future.
Yeah,
thank you so much
for your time as well.
Thank you,
appreciate it. The C4 podcast is brought to you by the Lao American Sports Hall of Fame. Visit us on the web at laoamericansports.com, celebrating the first, inspiring the next.